Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. It's great to have Tony Abbott back at the Sydney Institute. I should have mentioned that Tony Abbott's book, Battle Lines, Janet Grundy's managed to get a few copies and they're upstairs, and I'm sure the opposition leader would be happy to sign them after, but he's not here for that reason. But Janet Grundy, being ever the entrepreneurial small businesswoman, is here selling copies, and that's very much in the tradition of the Sydney Institute. As I said, Tony Abbott makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here on many times before, so I don't have to say much about him except to say that he's very welcome, that of course he was a senior cabinet minister in the successful Howard government. I should say a successful senior cabinet minister in the successful Howard government. And since December 2009, the leader of the Liberal Party, and therefore of course the leader of the opposition. And tonight, Tony Abbott, not long back from his trip to Britain, is going to talk on the topic of making your own luck, a stronger economy for a stronger Australia. Mr. Abbott, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, Jared, thanks so much. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for the warm welcome. It is a pleasure to be here at the Sydney Institute. As Jared says, I've been here quite a few times before and I keep getting invited back, so obviously I'm not entirely a flop in these appearances. I do have to say, though, that I always find the preparation for these talks quite trying, because Jared likes to publish them afterwards, which means that I always have to have a script. I do have a script for you today, ladies and gentlemen. Don't be too intimidated by it, because it's in bold print, so that I don't need to use my glasses. But look, I am tonight trying to bring together the threads of coalition economic policy over the last 4 years, because I think we have a very good story to tell, and that's what I'm proposing to do this evening. Almost 50 years ago, an influential book described Australia as the lucky country. Author Donald Horne meant that we'd relied on our luck rather than on our insights or on our hard work to get where we are, but the irony was largely missed. As if to prove his point, the tag passed into popular use and ever since has helped to reinforce the complacent expectation that something would always turn up to keep us safe and prosperous. There is a complacent assumption from people who should know better that Australia is largely immune to the economic turmoil now threatening Europe, because China's growth guarantees our future prosperity. There's no doubt that the China boom has sustained Australia's economic success over the past decade. There should equally be no doubt that the boom will one day end. Otherwise, it would be the first never-ending boom in human history. Even if China's expansion does have several decades left to run, even if it does prove largely impervious to economic downturns elsewhere in the world, even if it does change from being investment to consumption driven without reducing the need for Australia's iron ore and coal, and even if it is then replaced by an equally benign to Australia India boom, it's important to make the most of our luck rather than to take it for granted. The next 100 years may well turn out to be the Pacific century, but it will only do so if its peoples work harder and have more entrepreneurial flair than their rivals. Even in a Pacific century, there will be no free ride for non-paying passengers. Because, ladies and gentlemen, the lesson of the Eurozone crisis is that a terrible judgment is eventually pronounced against countries and peoples that live beyond their means. The turmoil in Europe is largely a function of governments consistently living beyond their means in the expectation that someone else will pick up the bill. the iron law of economics and the constant lesson of history is that grief eventually comes to governments, no less than it does to companies or to families that spend more than they raise or borrow more than they can readily repay. Australia now faces a crisis mini-budget because the government has ignored these disciplines. The current government has been blind to the failures of Europe and to the successes of its predecessor. A crisis mini-budget is now necessary, regardless of how the government tries to spin it away, because Labor has turned an inherited surplus into the four largest deficits in our history, and we're now staring down the barrel of the fifth substantial deficit in a row. The situation in the various economies of Europe vindicates the Coalition's consistent critique of the Rudd-Gillard government's policies. It demonstrates that the difference between economic strength and weakness is the rigour with which government spending has been managed in the short term and the vigour with which economic reform has been pursued in the long term. In Greece, which is being massively bailed out and is in political crisis and economic gridlock, the budget deficit is 8% of GDP. Net interest payments, even at subsidised rates, are 10% of government outlays, and net government debt is about 140% of GDP. Growth this year is tipped to be negative 5% and unemployment 16% and rising steeply. In Italy, where the former Prime Minister has just resigned over the sovereign debt crisis, the budget deficit is 4% of GDP, net interest payments are over 8% of government outlays, and net government debt is 100% of GDP. This year in Italy, growth is expected to be just 0.5%, and unemployment over 8% and going up fast. In Britain, despite the biggest spending cuts in 50 years, the budget deficit is still over 8% of GDP, net interest payments are 5% of government outlays, and net government debt is 73% of GDP. Growth is forecast to be just over 1%, and unemployment 8% plus and rising. Even in the United States, which has accepted the need to get debt and deficit under control, but has yet to produce a clear plan to do so, the budget deficit is over 9% of GDP, net interest payments are over 4% of government outlays, and net government debt is 73% of GDP. Growth is forecast to be 1.5% and unemployment about 9%. Here's the comparison. Australia's collective budget deficits are just under 4% of GDP, Commonwealth net interest payments under 2% of government outlays, and net government debt, Commonwealth and state, about 8% of GDP. Our growth is expected to be 1.75%, and our unemployment rate about 5.25%. Our immediate economic prospects may be relatively good, but that's not grounds for complacency or self-congratulation, especially as international sentiment about Australia is weakening. A World Bank report released last month showed that Australia's ease of doing business ranking had fallen from 8th to 15th since 2007. The World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Index, released in September, had Australia's overall ranking fall from 16th to 20th in the past year. Our macroeconomic environment slipped from 17th to 26th, our burden of government regulation from 60th to 75th, and our budget balance from 67th to 86th, just one place behind Italy, in fact. As the forum pointed out in this year's report, more debt means higher taxes, and higher taxes means less business activity. As well, if Australia's terms of trade had been at their average over the 1980s and 90s, rather than at an all-time high, last year's Commonwealth budget deficit, all other things being equal, would have been more like $120 billion, or over 8% of GDP, instead of the $48 billion actually posted. A decade of such performances would put us in much the same position as some of the southern European countries. Of course, we don't have a large black economy, as bloated a public sector, or a tendency to retire at 50. Still, the dangers are clear. In the 1990s, the economic performance of Australia and Britain was quite similar. Both went through severe recessions early in the decade. In the second half of the 90s, growth averaged about 3.5% in Australia and 3% in the UK. Unemployment, about 8% in Australia and 7% in the UK. And the government deficit averaged about 1% of GDP in Australia, compared with just over 2% in the UK. In 1995, net government debt was almost identical at 25 and 26% of GDP, respectively. Two factors have contributed to the divergence since then. One, of course, was the China boom. The other was the prudent economic management of the Howard Costello government. The Australian budget was in strong surplus, averaging almost 1% of GDP between 1996 and 2007. Over much the same period, the Blair-Brown government allowed the UK budget deficit to average about 3% of GDP, with debt steadily growing, despite the good years of the last decade. To give credit where it's due, the Hawke-Keating Labor government deregulated financial markets, reduced tariffs, and began the process of privatisation and even some workplace relations reform. Building on this, not only did the Howard Costello government transform the Commonwealth's fiscal position, it enshrined Reserve Bank independence, strengthened bank regulation, extended workplace reforms, albeit taking these too far in the end, and began serious welfare reform. By contrast, the Rudd-Gillard government has turned a consistent $20 billion surplus into the four largest deficits in our history and a $70 billion net asset position into $107 billion of net Commonwealth debt. It's rolled back not just the final round of the Howard government's workplace changes, but some of the Keating government's changes too. Days lost through strikes, though still very low by earlier standards, are now over three times greater than in the last year of the Howard government. So Australia's current economic position owes far more to the reforms of previous governments than to the spending spree of the current one. Since 2007, the US budgetary position has deteriorated by about 7% of GDP, the UK budgetary position by just under 6% of GDP, and the Australian position by over 5% of GDP, despite the absence of an Australian banking crisis and despite the China boom-derived maintenance of employment. In other words, Australia's recent fiscal performance has been scarcely better than that of others facing much worse circumstances. Our current strength, such as it is due to what we took into the global financial crisis rather than the way we've managed it. Although headline economic growth has remained solid, GDP per person has increased by just one half of 1% since late 2007, compared to annual growth of 2.25% between 1996 and the end of the Howard government. This is why so many people are convinced that Australia is now a rich country at serious risk of becoming poorer. As much as any other government, ours has made the fundamental mistake of thinking that a crisis largely caused by too much spending and too much borrowing could be addressed by yet more spending and yet more borrowing, with a preference for yet more taxing should the deficit need to be reined in. To every problem, the current government's response has been a new tax, a new regulation, or a new bureaucracy. It's making our industries less competitive with a unilateral carbon tax that's all economic pain for no environmental gain. It's damaging the mining industry with a success tax on our biggest exports that doesn't give smaller miners a fair go. And it's spending $50 billion plus connecting fibre to almost every home, whether they need it, want it, or can afford to pay more for it, while our roads are clogged, our railways antiquated, and ships wait expensively at sea because our ports can't cope. The government has made our economy less productive by closing down the live cattle trade in a panicked overreaction to a TV program. it's progressively closing down much of the Tasmanian forestry industry as part of its alliance with the Greens. It's spending $2 billion to close down the brown coal power stations that have been the source of Victoria's cheap power comparative advantage in manufacturing. And it's spending $11 billion to buy and close Telstra's copper network. In other words, it's spending billions in borrowed money to put people out of work, not into it. Now, next year's OECD growth forecast for the Eurozone has already been cut from 2% to just 0.3%, and there could easily be worse to come. In the short term, even a managed breakup of the euro would probably cause a significant recession in Europe. A disorderly breakup could be more confidence-crushing than the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which triggered the global financial crisis. The French and the German attachment to the euro is deep, but it's hard to have one monetary policy for 17 different fiscal policies, or to see the southern Europeans long allowing their domestic policies to be dictated from Berlin. Yet the more threatening the world economic situation becomes, the more the Australian government insists that it's the best possible time to clobber our economy with a carbon tax and a mining tax, as if new taxes could ever give countries prosperity. After insisting for months that it was on track to deliver the promised budget surplus next year, the government is finally talking about new spending cuts, but is apparently proposing to announce them in December after Parliament has risen with the mid-year economic and fiscal outlook statement. The government's complacency about debt and deficit at a time when household savings are at a generational high largely explains its collapse, the collapse of its standing as an economic manager. Government ministers seem to be on a different planet from struggling small businesses and families doing it tough. A recent survey of company directors showed that a massive 83% believed that the government didn't understand business. An astonishing 49% nominated the government itself as one of the three key obstacles to business in Australia. Only the government's most hardened apologists now claim that it's competent and credible. The computers in schools program turned out to cost more than twice the forecast and to take 2 years longer to deliver. The original mining tax was ultimately going to raise twice the initially forecast revenue. No one now believes that the national broadband network can be built for the $36 billion that the government still insists upon, even though the initial construction tender collapsed. The government's forecasts for the carbon tax assume, in Treasury's words, comparable carbon pricing in other major economies from 2015 to 16. But President Obama's statement last week that the United States would not be introducing a carbon tax or an emissions trading scheme, on top of Canada's equivalent declaration at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Perth, showed that the government's key assumption is unrealistic and self-serving. The Centre for International Economics, making the much more realistic assumption of a patchy international carbon market, has forecast a 2020 carbon price in current dollars of $43 a tonne, not $29, a cumulative carbon tax-induced loss of output of $180 billion, not $32 billion, households over $11,000 worse off over the period, not $5,000, and power prices up 30% by 2020, which is far higher than the 10% the government asserts for the initial impact of the tax. The government presented its carbon tax modelling report with the title Strong Growth, Low Pollution. Under the carbon tax, according to the government's own modelling, gross national income per person will rise 1.5% over the coming decade. But this is actually one-third lower than the 2.4% average annual growth rate achieved between 1990 and 2010 without a carbon tax. Curiously, and again this is according to the government's own modelling, Australia's domestic emissions will actually rise over the decade to 2020 under the carbon tax at an average rate of 0.75% a year. This is actually three times faster than the average 0.25% a year growth in domestic emissions recorded over the preceding two decades without a carbon tax. Incidentally, the carbon tax assumptions provide an astonishing counterpoint to the government's rationale for another of its mega schemes, the NBN. With the carbon tax, the government assumes that technology will change rapidly, with fundamental breakthroughs within the next 10 to 15 years. With telecommunications, the government assumes that no technology will emerge to challenge fibre as a delivery mechanism. The government insists that a carbon tax is needed to create a competitive market, to create what Professor Garnaut terms the genius of the market, no less. With the NBN, though, it not only insists on picking the single technology for the next generation, but directs that all competition with this new network must be shut down. If the government's carbon tax assumptions are not worth the paper they're written on, neither is the forecasting, and neither is the compensation package based on the forecasting. The forecasting must be done again, based on more realistic expectations, and the compensation package must be recast based on the new figures if struggling families are not to be ripped off. Without more tax cuts and more pension increases, there can be no adequate compensation for the carbon tax. Without more spending cuts, only a miracle could deliver the promised budget surplus next year. So an urgent mini-budget must be presented to the Parliament if the government is to have any economic credibility. Ladies and gentlemen, earlier this month, Deloitte Access Economics said that next year's budget position had slipped from a $3.5 billion surplus to a $1.9 billion deficit, a net turnaround of $5.4 billion. Last week, the consultancy Macroeconomics said that slower growth and sluggish receipts would put the budget in deficit to the tune of $6 billion next year, not the promised $3.5 billion without policy change. So the government now needs a mini-budget containing at least $6 billion in savings if it is to rescue the surplus that it's guaranteed, and it should recall Parliament to allow its new policy to be scrutinised. Now, ladies and gentlemen, make no mistake, there is a better way. Government's economic task is twofold: to live within its means and to make the changes needed to build a more productive economy with higher economic growth. Getting these fundamentals right is the best way to ensure that Australia continues to develop as a sophisticated and diverse economy. It's much more likely than a mining tax to foster a five-pillar economy with strong manufacturing and agricultural sectors, as well as a resources one, a strong services economy, including banking, retail and tourism, and a strong knowledge economy, including education, skills, research and IT. This is essential if Australia's standard of living is to remain high with secure, well-paid jobs. The Coalition believes that the first challenge for government is to live within its means, as families and other households do. Lower spending means lower taxes. Less borrowing means lower interest rates. Lower taxes and lower interest rates mean less pressure on families' cost of living. That's why the Coalition will end Labor's toxic taxes, end Labor's waste, and start to repay Labor's debt. That way, we can restore hope, reward and opportunity by getting our country back on track. Now, if the government is looking for mini-budget savings, the obvious place to start is the programs that have become bywords for waste, discontinuing the Computers in Schools program, which parents are now having to pay for anyway, could save over $500 million. Not proceeding with the extra bureaucracies associated with the largely business-as-usual hospital reforms that no one will notice could save well over $500 million. Not proceeding with the so-called GP superclinics, which are delivering new buildings, not more doctors, could save about $200 million. Big savings could be made in the government's $350 a throw set-top box program, since Gerry Harvey can supply and install for just half the price. vastly reducing the number of consultancies, which have cost over $2 billion over the past 4 years, would also produce significant savings. Reducing government travel, such as most of the 49 public servants set to go to the Durban Climate Change Conference, would show taxpayers that their government no longer thinks that money grows on trees. After all, a government which can't be trusted on small spending decisions can't be trusted with big ones. The current government, for instance, recently sold the Parliament House billiard tables for $5,000 and then spent $102,500 to establish whether this was good value for money. I am not making this up, ladies and gentlemen. It's in the Senate Hansard. So the quicker the government returns to surplus, the quicker it can start repaying debt and reducing interest repayments. Just this year, interest repayments will net out at $5.5 billion. To put it another way, just this year, the Gillard government, the Gillard-Brown government, will spend more on debt repayments than its combined annual spending on the ABC, SBS and other broadcasting. Cultural heritage, such as the Australia Council, Aboriginal health programs, legal services and science and research capacity. So, ladies and gentlemen, the Coalition does have a clear alternative. We will deliver personal income tax cuts and a fairer deal for pensioners without a carbon tax. We will deliver some company tax cuts without a mining tax. This will require significant cuts to government spending, which won't be easy, but are achievable and will be spent out in detail in good time before the next election. Since becoming opposition leader, I've said no to a carbon tax because I say yes to affordable power. I've said no to a mining tax because I say yes to investment and jobs in our strongest industry. I've said no to mandatory pre-commitment for poker machines because I say yes to more effective counselling and yes to a less intrusive nanny state. The Coalition hasn't just talked about lower spending. We've demonstrated through the savings we took to the last election a determination to take the hard decisions to deliver it. At the coming election, we will trim by natural attrition the Commonwealth Public Service by at least 12,000 to save at least $4 billion over the forward estimates period. Not proceeding with the carbon tax alone will deliver $31 billion in savings over the period, with a net improvement of $4 billion in the budget bottom line. As the Coalition has insisted, almost since the GFC hit, a swift return to surplus matters, because lower spending does mean less borrowing and less upward pressure on interest rates. Cutting spending is the precondition for tax cuts that don't just churn money from one pocket to the other. Deloitte Access Economics has recently estimated that a $13 billion reduction in Commonwealth spending would allow interest rates to be a full percentage point lower than otherwise would be needed to contain inflation against the backdrop of the mining boom. Building a stronger economy, though, requires more than simply getting the budget into order. The second challenge is to implement policies that will boost economic growth. The Coalition has a six-point plan to boost productivity, genuine welfare reform to lift participation in work, public sector reform to deliver better, more cost-effective services, red tape reform to cut business regulatory costs by at least $1 billion a year, competition reform to ensure that large and small businesses are competing on a genuinely level playing field, infrastructure reform to ensure best value from Commonwealth spending, and finally, labour market reform to encourage higher pay for better work. The Coalition also has a four-point plan for participation reform, mandatory work for the dole for unemployed people under 50, the extension of welfare quarantining for long-term unemployed people from the Northern Territory to the rest of Australia, disability pension reforms to prevent the parking of people on welfare whose problems might not be permanent or fully incapacitating, and cutting off the dole for fit young people in areas where unskilled work is readily available. Getting more people into the workforce and especially more people more productively into the workforce will mean a larger economy, a bigger tax base, and more ability for the government to fund better services without punishing tax increases or spending cuts elsewhere. The government's own budget papers, for instance, suggest that a 1% increase in growth through higher productivity and participation would produce an ongoing improvement in the budget bottom line of about $4.4 billion a year that would then be available to fund tax cuts or better services. So, ladies and gentlemen, the Coalition already has many of the policies it needs for the next election because it retains the ones it took to the last election. Some will require adjustment to take account of what the government's done subsequently or tougher fiscal circumstances. Mostly, though, the policies we take to the next election will be refined and developed versions of the policies we took to the last one. Sensible political parties, even in opposition, don't reinvent themselves from one election to the next, but find ways of giving contemporary expression to values that don't change. We won't keep Labor's national broadband network because there's no need for a government monopoly on services that a comparative market can provide. There will be a Fair Dinkum paid parental leave scheme because women need real options to combine family and a career if workforce participation is to be maximised. More trees, often planted by the Coalition's new Green Army. Better soils and smarter technology remain the best way to reduce emissions, not a great big new tax on jobs and families' cost of living. The next Liberal National Government will be different from the last, but we've well and truly assimilated the lessons of the Howard Government, in which no fewer than 16 members of the Shadow Cabinet served as ministers. Unlike our opponents, we understand in the marrow of our bones that you can't have a society without an economy to sustain it, and you can't have an economy without businesses that make a profit. That's why our plan is for a stronger economy, for a stronger Australia. Right now, Australians' natural confidence is subdued, notwithstanding our habitual optimism, environmental endowments, and comparatively good economic prospects. People know that we can be better than this. They know that we have to make our luck, not just rely on it. A stronger economy, better services, more opportunities for work, and more secure borders are all achievable once a great country has the better government it deserves. Now, ladies and gentlemen, again, I do thank you for being such a good audience. I am thrilled that so many people have turned up. I should also say, Jared, that the calibre of the audience at the Sydney Institute is both impressive and a little intimidating. I say that because I'm staring as I speak at two distinguished former parliamentarians, a former deputy leader of the Federal Liberal Party, the Honourable Neil Brown, and a former leader of the State Liberal Party and Federal MP, Peter Coleman. But it's an eclectic group. It's not all ex-Liberals. I'm also looking at my friend, the former National President of the Australian Labor Party, Warren Mundine, who probably recognises some of the ideas here as ideas that he's been pushing. Thank you very much, Jared. It's a pleasure to be here.
Many thanks, Tony Abbott. We have to have a quality audience to match our speakers. Balance. Now, the opposition leader has kindly agreed to take questions and discussion on the topic of his talk, which is the tradition at the Sydney Institute. So we're taking questions broadly on economic matters along the lines that have been addressed, which is a very comprehensive speech. On a couple of assumptions, that it's probably going to be 2 years to the next election, and it's possible that, given what might occur in Europe and with an impact on China, that the economy in 2 years' time might be where it is now or
maybe a bit worse than where it is now. And you're talking a lot about the importance of rolling back some of the re-regulation that's occurred under the Rudd and Gillard governments. What kind of pitch would you make to small business about what you do in that whole area of regulation? Because as you know, in terms of job creation, they'll probably start, if jobs start to grow again, they'll start probably in small business. What would your pitch there be?
Well, I guess I'd be making three points to them. First of all, Jared, the coalition understands small business in a way that our opponents don't, because so many of our members of parliament come from small business. It's very hard to think of any contemporary Labor members of parliament who have a genuine small business background. I guess Peter Garrett might say that as a singer he was a kind of a small businessman, and I suppose Rob McClellan might say that as a lawyer for a union law firm he has some kind of a business background, but the vast majority of contemporary Labor MPs are people who've been on the payroll as union officials or party officials or perhaps as public sector employees for years before going into the parliament. And I think this produces a fundamental lack of understanding of small business in particular on the part of the ALP. The second point I'd make is that in the end, policies specifically pitched for small business are important, but even more important is getting the economic fundamentals right. And taxes will always be lower because spending will always be lower under the coalition than under the Labor Party. The third point I'd make is that we are going to make a much more serious attempt at red tape reduction than we were able to under the former government. One of the few promises that the Howard Costello government, didn't end up keeping was a promise we made in 1996 to cut red tape by 50%. I regret to say that we failed in that area. Since then, though, I think we have a better idea of what works here. And believe it or not, the Victorian Labor government came up with a program which does appear, according to the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, to have been successful in reducing red tape. Under the Victorian program, continued enthusiastically by the new Liberal government of Victoria, each department is asked to estimate the costs that it is imposing on its departmental clients through its rules and regulations, and it is given an annual target for taking costs off. So the public servants actually have to work to a target for reducing the burdens that they impose on their clients, and it's left to them to decide which burdens they most want to get off, but they do have to do it, and the public service bonuses and so on are dependent upon meeting this key performance indicator. As I said, according to the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, it is actually working, and there is less red tape in Victoria now than there was just a few years ago, and that's the program on which we would be modelling our Commonwealth approach, and which we are looking to use to give savings to business of at least $1 billion a year.
Microphone coming down. Michael, if you push. Yes, Mr. Abbott, Ian Higgins from the Australian newspaper. In your speech, I noticed that it wasn't until page 7 that you actually started talking about what a coalition government would do. Previous pages up till 7 were negative comments on the coalition management. You've been called Dr. No by the opposition, and you've also been attacked by the government for not actually outlining how you would achieve these massive savings that you're speaking of while still keeping some of the goodies like the superannuation increase, etc., etc. And you're proposing...
We've got one speaking. Just keep it a bit brief. There's a lot of people here.
Sure, okay.
We've got a speaker already.
Okay. Okay, so how do you answer that, and when will you start providing more positive policies and more specific ideas about how you will cut spending?
Well, Ian, I'm quite flattered that of a 27-page speech, only the first 7 pages were negative. I think that makes it much more positive than negative on the arithmetic. But, prior to the last election, we identified $50 billion worth of savings. The Treasury did its best to attack those savings. It identified about $10 billion that it thought were questionable. But I've got to say, I think that there were very strong arguments that the Treasury was being too zealous in its questioning, given that conservative bias allowance saving was subsequently allowed when the government tried to do much the same thing. Second round effect savings have frequently been allowed by the former government and indeed by the current government, and their criticisms that we didn't actually know some figures upon which our savings were based, because the figures, the real figures, were different from the published figures, I think was more a comment on the mendacity of the government than on the economic competence of the opposition. So I say, judge us, Ian, not by the government's spin, but by our record. Judge us by our record. Judge me by my record. Judge the coalition by what we've done, not by what the government says of us. And I think if you look at what we've done, when it comes to cutting spending, we have a record which is unparalleled for a modern political party.
Question up the back.
Tony, I want to ask about industrial action. I'm old enough to remember when we had union disputes arbitrated and all the rest of it. After the Qantas dispute and then the nurses in Victoria, we seem to have gone back to an age where we had strikes, then arbitration. Have you got any answers to how we might stop doing that?
Well, and I'm old enough to remember the bad times and the good times as well, and I particularly remember a learned journalist and commentator who used to write amusingly about the fringe dwellers, and I think you married him eventually. But I don't know that he was dwelling in the fringe that much at the time. But anyway, look, we do have a problem, and I'm not going to preempt policy announcement that the coalition will make at a time of its choosing nearer to the next election. But at the risk of sounding like a broken record, we will have a strong and effective workplace relations policy. It will be based on problem solving, not on ideology, and it will address the productivity question, disputation question, and the flexibility question, which plainly is given rise to by the Act as it currently stands.
Question, I try and take our members if I can find them. It's our policy to take our members first. Yes, because they pay to get here. It's a question. Question up here.
Tony Gaulders with Mr. Abbott. Given that much of our prosperity has been because of our fortuitous position with iron ore and coal and so on, coinciding with China's massive growth and so on, what sort of long-term plan will the government have? That's going to decline one day. What's the long-term plan that the government should do, or should have in mind, to create a compensation for that and keep our economy in good condition?
Okay, well, this idea that the money which is made from selling iron ore and coal to the Chinese is somehow frittered away, I think is not correct. The profits which BHP and Rio and the other companies make go to people, mostly Australians, very often indeed to Australians who have BHP and Rio shares as part of their superannuation policies. So this idea that the money is being wasted, I think fundamentally misconceives the nature of a capitalist market economy. That money is not wasted. It is in the hands of the Australian public ultimately, and I trust the Australian public to get it right more often than not with this money. To be honest, I instinctively would trust the public to get it right with investment decisions more than I would trust the government to get it right with investment decisions. That's my instinctive position, although I should note that the former government in which I served as a minister did establish a form of a sovereign wealth fund, the Future Fund, which it invested about $60 billion in from surpluses achieved in the last few years of the government's life. Now, I think that is something that I would like to see resume at some point, but we can't actually do that until we're back into surplus, until we've paid off the debt. At the moment, if we were to start talking about a sovereign fund, it would be a sovereign debt fund, not a sovereign wealth fund. We would be borrowing to put money into it, and borrowing money to give it to the government to invest, particularly if they're encouraged to speculatively invest, I don't think is a particularly sound policy.
Just yell out,
we'll
pick it up.
Well, in view of the recent Andrew Bolt case and the current inquiry into the Brexit in Australia, many people don't know what you're allowed to say.
Well, it's a question about free speech, but we were going to take questions on the topic. But
well, I'm happy to address that. Look, I think you raise a very fair question. You know, the Voltairean view, I think it was Voltaire, wasn't it? I disagree with what you say, sir, but I defend to the death your right to say it.
Allegedly, sir.
Allegedly. I mean, that has been one of the great rallying cries of the left, has it not? And yet there weren't too many members of the left rushing to Andrew Bolt's defence when he was pinged, as he was. Look, we've committed to changing that aspect of the law, that particular provision. We've committed to changing that should we form a government. There's no way that we would be emulating the current government's inquiry into the media. I mean, this is a thinly veiled attempt to bully News Limited. It's really an appalling piece of public policy. Again, it's a lynch mob that's been inspired by Senator Brown, who certainly does seem to have extraordinary influence over the current government. And there are many reasons for wanting a change of government, but one of the strongest of those reasons is that we don't really need Bob Brown as the Associate Prime Minister of Australia.
Got to be quick now. We're getting. Yep.
Mr. Abbott.
Come on.
Thank you.
Let's go.
The Productivity Commission looked at a national disability insurance scheme, and this is an economic question.
Uh-huh.
We've got tens of thousands of highly educated, highly qualified people who are excluded from a tight labour market. We have heard wishy-washy things from the government. We've seen nothing that there's nothing in forward estimates, there's nothing in the law, so it really doesn't exist. What is the coalition going to do about this very, very important thing? People can't wait anymore.
Well, look, I understand your frustration and I sympathise with it, but this is a very complex area. As you know, disability services in this country have traditionally been state responsibilities, but these days, if you want major reform, people normally look to the federal government. But it's particularly difficult to get significant change where you need to have cooperation not only within governments but between governments. Now, I'm not going to criticise the Gillard government on this. They have put in place a mechanism for progress. I fear, based on the record of such mechanisms, that it might in the end be a terrible disappointment, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt because it's only been in place now for a few months. They've set aside a modest amount of money to take forward the process, and there is now, as I understand it, a COAG working group to try to understand how much will need to come from the feds, how much will need to come from the states in order to meaningfully fund this new proposal for what will effectively be Medicare for people with significant disabilities. Now, we've said that we support it in principle, but this is not something that you can readily manage from opposition. I know I'm disappointing you, but it is an improvement on what we have. To have the Productivity Commission auspice this kind of thing is significant, and to have both sides of politics saying that they take it seriously and want to take it forward is also quite significant. And I know the vast numbers of people who have a close personal interest in this are very eager for rapid change, but rapid change might end up being the wrong change rather than the right change, but change there must be.
There's one question over there. Second last question, we've got to be quick.
Hi, Tony Stefan Wisniewski. Always a pleasure to have my local MP speaking and doing so well, so keep that up. Thank you. The question actually was on healthcare and the economics of healthcare, subject close to my heart as a recent heart surgery patient. And the question really was around integrated sort of cradle to grave or bench top to bench type of thinking about the healthcare system, which is such a high cost. It so personally affects all of us and our families, and yet it's so complex in this country with various levels and sectors and programs and so on. I was just wondering what the Tony Abbott perspective on healthcare is at this point.
Well, I could take the soft option and refer you to the policy document that we took to the last election. Stefan, healthcare is always going to be a work in progress. It's very complex, as you say. It's very expensive. And there'll almost always be lots of things that people would prefer to be done better and differently. In terms of more integrated, holistic healthcare, I think there are two potential sources of this to whom or to which we can look. The first is the private health insurers who have a strong incentive to keep their patients healthy rather than just treated, and a lot of the private health insurers are now moving into this space. The second is to try to ensure that GPs are not just managing illness, but are trying to promote wellness. Now, when I was the health minister, at the risk of going back into ancient history and sounding a bit self-glorifying, I tried to move us down this direction by introducing things like GP care plans for the chronically ill, mental health plans for people with mental illness. Now, I think these have made a significant difference. I think there's still a long way to go, because part of the problem here is changing the mindset of our GPs as much as anything else. I hesitate to say this because I can see some senior doctors, or at least one senior doctor, not nodding at me in the audience, but I think the better younger doctors are probably more oriented towards this than some of their older peers. An important part of this is trying to ensure that we get the best and the brightest of our medical graduates into general practice, not just into high-end specialties at teaching hospitals. So there's quite a lot of cultural shifts that will be needed if this kind of transformation is to work. But I think that's the best, those are the most promising avenues down which we can advance to get change in this area.
Just a final question, because we have to finish by 7. You've just come back from meeting with the Conservatives from Europe and North America. Mm-hmm. I mean, what kind of message to do they give of the economies in the North Atlantic? Is it depressing? Is it sort of just down? Is it...
Jared has neglected his own advice about the microphones, but he's asked, what is the message from fellow Liberal Conservatives from Europe and North America? How pessimistic are they about the economic situation? Look, I'm an incorrigible Anglophile, as some of you would know, and I love spending time in London, and the streets are packed, the shops are full, the restaurants you could hardly get into. I mean, London looked as booming and as rich as ever, and yet the companion to every conversation was a sense of foreboding about the Eurozone crisis. Now, I think the Eurozone crisis does threaten to bring on prolonged economic stagnation or worse in Europe. And while we are not nearly as dependent upon Europe now as we might have been 50 years ago, I think it will be difficult for a prolonged slowdown in Europe not to have an impact elsewhere. What's the right response? Well, I think the tougher the times, the more urgent it is to get the fundamentals right. And it's always right to try to get government spending under better control. It's always right to try to ensure that taxes are lower and fairer and simpler. It's always right to try to make our economic structures more efficient. It's never right to engage in wasteful spending. And if there's one thing, Jared, that I think has damaged the reputation of the current government more than anything, it's this sense that these guys just don't understand the value of a dollar, that they throw money at problems, they don't carefully analyse them and exercise the same frugal stewardship over our money in their hands as we would exercise over our money in our hands. So I think that my fellow Liberal Conservatives in the Northern Hemisphere are acutely conscious of the need for sound, prudent fiscal management, and this is why I think as time goes by, the Howard Costello government will be even more of a role model than it might have been in the past, and why Peter Costello should have statues erected to him in the great financial capitals of the world.
I know there were some more questions, but we always finish on 7 o'clock, so I'll be very brief. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Battle Lines. If you don't have one, you can get one tonight, but I think many of you have one. Many thanks to Tony Abbott for a very comprehensive speech across a range of economic matters and for taking close to 30 minutes of questions and discussion. So thanks for tonight, and
best wishes for the future, and no doubt we'll have you back here in the not too distant future.
Thanks so much. Thank you. A pleasure. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.